The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Guys, I want to wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. We're rolling into Thanksgiving. And I do want to mention to you that I won't be doing the podcast Thursday through Sunday. I don't do it on the weekend anyway. But I'll be back in the saddle next Monday. So looking forward to that. I hope you have a great weekend. I'd like to say just a word about Thanksgiving. We do have, despite all our political woes, a lot to be thankful for. And as I think about Thanksgiving, I'm thinking not so much about the pilgrims and the Indians. I'm thinking really just more about the how much fun it is to live in America, just the kind of dynamism of American life. You know, yesterday I had the Harvard scholar Ruth Weiss on the podcast, and we were talking about Jewish literature. And I don't know if it came up, but one of the novels that she talks about and teaches is a novel by Saul Bellow, the Nobel laureate. It's called Herzog. And I want to just read the first line of that novel, because to me, it kind of captures what I'm talking about America. It's kind of a crazy line. "If I'm out of my mind, it's all right with me," thought Moses Herzog. Let's think about this for a minute. First of all, just the way the line is written, right? It's not Moses Herzog thought. You get his thought first before you are introduced to him. So you're forced to participate in the thought. In fact, for a moment, you think it's the author speaking. "If I'm out of my mind," there are no quote marks, "it's all right with me." Now, what is Herzog really saying here? He's saying, in effect, that if people think I'm crazy, but not just if they think if I'm crazy, if I'm a little crazy, it's all right with me. And obviously, Herzog isn't crazy in the normal sense. He's not somebody who needs to be in an asylum. But what he really means is that he's out there. He lives a highly experimental life. He is constantly, it turns out, getting into trouble, getting himself out of trouble. But what's... Debbie says, "I can see why you identify with this guy." Dinesh says, "If it's all out of his mind, it's all right with Dinesh. If people hate him, it's all right with Dinesh. In fact, he likes it. He wonders how he can get them to hate him more. How can he aggravate them even further?" See, exactly. Now, with Herzog, what's striking about this line, and I'll close on this, is it's the self-consciousness of Herzog. That's why it's important, thought Moses Herzog. He's aware of the way that he appears in public space. And he's also aware that he's breaking the mold. And that, in some ways, is the American way. It's not conformity. It's not hierarchy. It is breaking the mold. And in this sense, we get to live lives that are, in a way, more interesting, more unique. American lives differ more from one another than, say, lives of people in India or in other countries. So let's give thanks for all the blessings we have. And by the way, here we go. Here's what's coming up today. I'm going to talk about Victor Davis Hanson's argument that the progressive North is now becoming like the old South. Very interesting. I'm going to talk about the University of California system, which is getting rid of standardized testing. And I'm going to tell you why. It's not the reason that they give. Biden is opening up the strategic oil reserve to solve an emergency. What's the emergency? His falling poll numbers. And finally, I'm going to talk about a strange phenomenon. Muslims in large numbers are converting to Christianity for the first time in history. And I'll talk about why. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
I want to talk about the neo-Confederates of today, the party, if you will, of the Confederacy. Now, for a lot of leftists, that's the Republican Party. There was a big switch, and the Republican Party is now the party of the Confederacy. But this is not true. The Republican Party, in fact, remains anchored to its Lincoln tradition. The Democrats remain the party of racism. But I'm not going to talk about the party so much. There's a very interesting article in American Greatness by Victor Davis Hanson. And he's talking about the strange way in which the progressive North, and he's thinking particularly of the cities in the North, have become like the old South. Now, let's think for a moment about the old South. The old South was a racially obsessed society. Racially obsessed not merely in the line between white and black and the idea that the blacks were inferior, they deserved to be slaves, but also in the very strange way that the poor whites in the South were themselves, even though they had no direct stake in slavery, they were taught, largely by the Democrats, a kind of racial ideology that said, hey, you might be a poor farmer, you may have no money, but you know what, you're superior to all the blacks in the region. You have a higher position on the totem pole due to race. So race becomes the kind of determinative factor. Number two, the old Confederacy used the idea of states' rights to try to overturn national norms and federal laws. So states' rights would be used to cast a kind of veto over the federal policies, particularly policies put in place by the Republicans. Third, the Old South was very hierarchical. It was a top-down society. It was run by elites, the planter class, the slave owner class, particularly the people who owned the big plantations. The normal size of a plantation in America was about 10 to 20 slaves, so kind of medium-sized. But the people who owned 500, 1,000, in some cases 2,000 slaves, these were the giant plantations, hugely profitable. And this was the sort of aristocracy, if you will, of the old Confederate South. And finally, the South was stagnant. It did produce cotton, but apart from so-called King Cotton, it didn't produce a whole lot else. And so what happened is that as immigrants came to America, they didn't go to the South. They went to the North because there were jobs, there was opportunity, there was upward mobility. The dynamic part of America was the industrial North, and in fact was the cities of the North. It was places like Detroit and Baltimore and Boston, and then later places like San Francisco and Seattle as the country was settled all the way across the continent. Now, here's the interesting point. If you look at the progressive northern cities today, they have all these qualities that I just described that characterize the old South. So number one, they are racially obsessed. You go to northern cities today, they want to hand out university positions based on race. They want to hand out jobs based on race. Everything depends on whether you are white or black and marking you as one or the other. And you can't get out of it. There's no sense that you get to sort of determine your own future. The idea is you are immediately classified and that determines whether or not you have more or less opportunity. Even the laws enshrine these racial categories. Number two, you notice that northern cities, some of them have become sanctuary cities. And what does that mean? It means nothing more than that they use states' rights. We're California. We don't have to follow the immigration laws. We're going to allow illegals to come here and we're going to give them driver's licenses. We're going to give them a state aid. We're going to give them college scholarships. So what is this doing if not an effort by the part of these cities and states to nullify, to override, to get around federal laws in exactly the same way that the old Confederacy used states' rights to this purpose, to get around the law. Third, if you look at northern cities, and San Francisco is a classic example, they're very hierarchical. There's a small group of people, the Silicon Valley moguls, the political types like Gavin Newsom, Nancy Pelosi, and they pretty much run the place. They operate like a hereditary aristocracy. No rules apply to them. No walls for anybody else. They have tall walls. No guns for anyone else. They have guns and private security. So they function like the old slave owner class.
in which they operate in a kind of upper tier that is not available to anyone else. And finally, these cities are now stagnant, just like the old South. There is no real opportunity there. Yes, you can come in as a busboy and end up as a waiter, but there's not a whole lot else you can do. You're stuck. The working class is stuck. In fact, many of them live in shanty-like conditions, almost like the old slave quarters. And so you see a movement today, which is the opposite of the movement in the 19th century. In the 19th century, people were moving away from the South and toward the opportunity-filled industrial cities of the North. But now, think about it. People are moving out of New York, out of New Jersey. They're moving away from cities like Detroit and Baltimore. Why? Because those places have become, you know, hellholes to a degree. It's no fun anymore to live there. And they've been moving. Where have they been moving? They've been moving south, and they've been moving west to places like Texas and Florida. So I think Victor Davis Hanson is onto something here, and that is that you now have, in a strange way, liberal America resembling the old South and conservative America, particularly the cities of the conservative South and the rural areas of the South, representing new zones of American opportunity and social mobility. Guys, I don't know if you saw the great picture today. Rittenhouse is with President Trump. And guess who bailed this guy out of jail? None other than our own friend, Mike Lindell. What a great guy. And this is a guy who suffered for taking this kind of a stance. His MyPillow doesn't have their normal box stores or their shopping channels. They've been kind of canceled. Well, the benefit of that is they're going to pass on the savings directly to you. You can get the lowest price in the history of MyPillow for the classic standard MyPillow. It's normally $69.98, but now $19.98 with promo code Dinesh. These wonderful pillows won't go flat. You can wash and dry them as often as you want. They maintain their shape. They're made in the USA. Queen size pillows, regularly $79.98, now $24.98. King size, normally $89.98, now $29.98. So, and MyPillow isn't just pillows. They've got over 150 products, deep discounts, everything from sleepwear to my new beds. Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-876-0227. Use promo code Dinesh to take advantage of Mike's special offers, not just on the pillows, but on all the products. That number again, 800-876-0227. Just go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. I want to explore in a little bit of depth the decision by the University of California to get rid of standardized testing as a means to get into the university UC system. UC Provost Michael Brown has made the announcement. He's basically said that we're going to now have test-free admissions. This is to say that UC system now will use things like grades. It'll use recommendations. It will use the college application essay. It will use extracurriculars. And those are going to be the ways in which it decides who gets into school. No more standardized tests. Now, UC is a huge system. It's in some ways also a bellwether, a kind of a leading system of state universities in the country. So it is quite possible, in fact, likely, I would say, that other colleges are going to also move in this direction. There's been a movement against standardized testing for a few decades now, but it hasn't really gathered full steam. And I think this latest effort by UC might push it so that it becomes the norm to apply to college and not have to take a standardized test. Now, interestingly, the UC system asked a faculty group to look into these tests and see if they harmed the enrollment of disadvantaged students. And the faculty leadership concluded in 2020 the opposite. They said, no, these standardized tests are actually good for disadvantaged students. Why? Because they allow disadvantaged students to take a test, the same test that everybody else takes, and show that they might be poor or disadvantaged, but they're smart and they deserve to be at UC. So the test becomes a great ladder that allows you to kind of show what you can do in the same way that any other objective test applied across the board is going to demonstrate. You want to show that you can play basketball, just get on the court, play by the same rules as everyone else, demonstrate your skills. But interestingly, the moment that the faculty committee did that, there was a kind of left-wing backlash. And there was a lawsuit filed by the Compton Unified School District, where basically they teach nothing all over Compton. This is an overwhelmingly black school district, basically claiming that the SAT violated their civil rights. Think about this. Think about the absurdity of claiming that a test based upon vocabulary, based upon reasoning skills, and based upon essentially elementary or basic math skills violates your civil rights. Why? Because it actually demands that you have some academic preparation and know stuff and know how to use your mind. Now, the group that was considering getting rid of the SAT at the UC system decided, well, maybe we can find a better test. Maybe there's another test, not the SAT, that's going to work better. And so they looked at something called the Smarter Balance Test, which is apparently a test that has been painstakingly devised to try to increase the enrollment of blacks and Hispanics. But guess what? It turns out that no test can be devised. It's not even possible to come up with one where all racial groups perform equally. I guess it is possible to come up with such a test. Maybe it's I would call it the cartwheel test or the stand on your head test. But you can't think of an academic test measuring anything relevant to colleges in which you don't get a result in which Asian Americans generally do the best, whites do second, Hispanics do third, and African Americans or black students do fourth or lowest of all. So this is the heart of the problem. And I think the universities are saying that if we look at subjective factors, grades, by the way, are highly subjective. Why? Because it depends on which school you went to. By the way, if you went to the Compton School, you can be, you know, essentially, you can have an IQ of 80 and still come out pretty well in class. So the fact of the matter is that there is no easy way to compare grades, even the same grade, at two different schools, which have a very different level of average achievement and are teaching very different types of students with different levels of academic preparation. So what happens is when you have extreme subjectivity, we're going to look at essays, we're going to look at recommendations. I mean, my aunt says I'm wonderful. My uncle says I'm the greatest guy since Jesus Christ. This is the kind of nonsense that essentially levels the idea of merit and gives admissions officers a chance to essentially use race and gender and sexual orientation, all the other nonsense that is unrelated to academic achievement, make those the decisive factors in who gets into the UC system. Now, in the next segment coming up, I'm going to probe two questions which have been studied over 30 years. Number one, are standardized tests good predictors of how you do in college? And two, are those tests biased in any way against blacks or Hispanics or other minorities? After taking Balance of Nature, Debbie and I have noticed a big increase in energy. And for Debbie, you know, regularity was also a problem. It was solved with this, the fiber and spice. Now, we love taking Balance of Nature because we can't possibly eat the correct servings of fruits and veggies every day. So for us, this really makes sense. In fact, our technical director, Brian, got curious about Balance of Nature. So we said, hey, you try it. And he says it really has done a lot of good for him. Brian's here, so I'm just going to have him bop his head in. Brian, what do you think? Taking Balance of Nature. Has it worked?
It's been really good. It really helps me kind of get more. It truly is a balance of those vegetables and all that, and get the vitamins that I'm missing out on some other meals. And I'm finding I'm not needing that extra cup of coffee later in the day. And it's helping me just really, since I'm feeling better, I'm actually doing things that are more healthy.
Oh, Brian, that's awesome. This is so good. It works. Debbie and I, we take 10 daily servings of fruits and veggies, all in 6 small capsules. There are no trouble swallowing, always fresh, nothing artificial. They smell great. So invest in your health, invest in your life. Join me, experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself for years to come. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. You got to use discount code America. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751. Or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America. Do standardized tests predict success? And are they racially biased or biased in some other way against blacks or Hispanics or women or really anyone? I'm considering this question because the University of California system is getting rid, not just of the SAT, not just of the ACT, but of all standardized testing. They're going to be looking merely at grades and college essays and recommendations and extracurriculars. Now, when we think about standardized testing, let's remember a few things. Number one, standardized testing was introduced almost a century ago in American higher education precisely to get rid of bias. In other words, in the old system, if you think about it, you had these prep schools and they had relationships with the colleges. So the dean at Yale would call up the admissions, the counselor at Phillips Exeter or Andover or one of the elite prep schools and go, well, you know, who have you got for me this year? And so this buddy-buddy relationship, there was a kind of a nepotistic arrangement between the prep schools and the elite colleges. And there were poor Irish and Italian and Jewish kids who said, hey, listen, you know, we might have gone to some inner city school in Philadelphia or New York, but we're smart. Give us a test. Give us the same test you're going to give to the kid at Andover, and we'll show you that we can do better, and you should admit us based upon a test administered neutrally across the board. So this is the introduction. This is the actual history of the SAT. Now, this kind of testing, standardized testing, is actually pretty common in many sectors of American life. Here's an example, by the way, of some tests that are used. The U.S. Employment Service administers a general aptitude test. The military uses the Armed Services Vocational Battery. There's the law school test, the LSAT, the GMAT for getting into graduate management. There's the graduate record exam. There's the Foreign Service, which administers the Foreign Service Entrance Exam. There are standardized tests that are used to hire postal clerks, teachers, police sergeants, firefighters, civil service personnel, office managers, architects, emergency dispatchers, air traffic controllers, certified public accountants, and on and on and on. Now, obviously, when you're looking at a test, the first question you have to ask is, does this test actually measure what it seeks to predict? A test is in a difficult business, the business of prediction. So the SAT is going to try to predict, how is this kid, if he were admitted, let's say, to the University of Michigan, how's he going to do there? And it turns out that the SAT is a reasonably good predictor, not of success in life. Sometimes critics will be, well, can't predict your success in life. Well, so success in life depends on a whole bunch of other things. Do you get along with people? Do you, you know, luck, family connections, a whole bunch of other factors. But what the SAT and the ACT, these standardized tests to get into college, are trying to predict is how you're going to fare academically in college or in that particular college. And it turns out it is, well, nothing is a perfect predictor, but it's a better predictor than any other measure. And it's kind of obvious when you think about it. Recommendations are ridiculously subjective. It depends on who you ask. No one's going to ask someone who sort of has a close-up look at all their faults. You're going to find someone who's essentially going to give a sanitized picture of you. So that's not going to be a very good predictor of anything. Extracurriculars are useful because they help to show your all-roundedness, but they're not going to predict how you're going to do academically. Your college essay is merely a predictor of one thing, your ability to write, and that's assuming you wrote your own essay without getting help, without having your uncle show up and go over your essay and rewrite it, and so on. So this is the beauty of a standardized test. It applies uniformly to everyone. High school grades, as I mentioned a moment ago, depend on which school you went to. Very often, high school grades are on a curve. It's relative to the other kids in your class. So for all these reasons, the SAT is the best measure we have. Standardized tests are. So let me turn for a moment to the issue of whether or not these tests are biased. And another way to put it is, you know, before there was a kind of, are the tests biased? Well, I noticed that 7 years ago on the SAT, they used the word regatta or sonata. And the idea is that, well, you know, wait a minute. You know, if you've gone sailing, if you live near the ocean, you know what a regatta is. If you've been exposed to classical music, you know what a, you know, so the idea here is that the test is measuring some cultural piece of information and not one's sort of, let's say, raw talent or ability to reason. And of course, over 30 years, the people who administer these tests have worked really hard so that in a weird way, culturally, they're now biased against those kinds of terms. And if you look at the SAT, and even when I took the SAT, going back to the late 1970s, it was full of quotations from Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. And it was written heavily to be, you may almost say, culturally biased in favor of blacks. In fact, if like me, you came from India, you might wonder who half these people were because you didn't have that kind of cultural knowledge that is drummed into young people as if all of American history was basically a kind of leapfrog from emancipation to Martin Luther King to Rosa Parks, leaving, by the way, almost everything else out. So there have been a whole bunch of studies. In fact, this is one of the most heavily studied topics, which is to say, do tests like the SAT predict not just the academic achievement of white students, but do they also predict at the same rate the achievement of black students, of Hispanic students, or is it the case that they are better predictors for whites and not so good predictors for other racial groups? Well, it turns out that this body of research points to a single conclusion. The SAT is actually a pretty good predictor of academic success for whites and for Hispanics and for women. The one group that is not as good a predictor is blacks. But guess what? It actually overpredicts black performance. So in other words, what it does is it says that this black kid will do better in college than he or she actually does. I think our conclusion in looking at all this is that the test is really not the problem. The test isn't creating differences of academic ability or academic performance. The test is like a thermometer. It's measuring these differences. It's kind of telling you have a fever. So the test is pointing to other social problems. And of course, in the black community, particularly inner cities, you have problems not just of poverty, you have problems of broken families, of drugs, of interfamilial violence. Those are the issues that cause, I think, black kids not to have the time, the peace, the motivation to do their homework. That reflects into poor performance on the test. So what I'd like to see is an effort focusing on the causes of why people don't do as well on tests, improve their test performance, rather than scapegoating and blaming the thing that is not to blame, namely the standardized test. Guys, we're in a new environment, runaway inflation, the danger of stagflation, stagnant growth and inflation. This is like Jimmy Carter all over again. So we need new investment strategies. We got to modify the old ones. And for a long time, I just invested in the stock market, all my eggs in one basket. Well, it was a good basket, but now we got to hedge our bets. We got a ridiculous regime in Washington. They're spending money. They're eroding the value of the dollar. So this is not the time to be reckless. I'm not saying get out of the market, but I am saying protect your savings and investments by putting a portion of them in gold and other precious metals. Birch Gold will help you do that. You can convert an IRA or eligible 401k into an IRA backed by precious metals. And here's an added incentive to do it. When you text Dinesh to 484848 and purchase precious metals with Birch Gold by December 23rd, you'll get free silver for every $5,000 you invest. Birch Gold has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. So go ahead, text Dinesh to 484848. Get free silver for every $5,000 you invest. Offer ends December 23rd. Once again, text Dinesh to 484848. Protect your savings today. Will there be any media accountability for the Russia collusion hoax? I don't think there really will. Now, in the mainstream media, there are lots of people pretending like they're doing a real self-examination. There's a major reckoning underway. All of this started, well, it started with the Durham indictments and all the information that came forward, really showing that Trump did not collude with Russia, that the Hillary Clinton campaign made up that lie. They planted the evidence. The evidence was then picked up and disseminated. And the point here is that the media, it's not that they fell for it. This is one of the common phrases. The media fell for it. No, they didn't fall for it. They were part of it. In fact, Hillary Clinton and her friends knew that the media could be counted on to play their appointed role. That's why they put it out this way. They put it out through the FBI to the media, knowing that the media would be like, wow, this is great. Let's go with this. And in that sense, the Russia collusion hoax fit Goebbels' definition of propaganda? Goebbels basically said propaganda is not judged by its literary quality or its believability. Essentially, if it works, it's good propaganda. And if it doesn't work, it's bad propaganda. So propaganda is measured by its result. And you have to say that by that definition, the hoax was successful. It put Trump on the defensive for his entire presidency. In fact, it almost got rid of Trump. It created all these bogus investigations, one on top of the other. And it's taken years for this hoax to be unraveled. Now, the Washington Post goes back and sort of amends large segments of its articles, one from March 2017, another from March of 2019. The New York Times runs a guest essay, quote, "How did so much of the media get the Steele dossier so wrong?" And again, you might expect an article like this to be, you know, a painful self-examination. But the writer of the article basically says, you know, this is just because reporters were a little gullible. I'm now quoting them. "Some reporters simply didn't like or trust Mr. Trump and didn't want to appear to be on his side." So this is a gross understatement of the issue. In a sense, you could almost say that these articles are intended to sanitize what actually happened, to minimize responsibility and to hide the true complicity of the media. The truth is that the media was, from the beginning, part of the lie. And you have all these reporters. By the way, this is a lie that produced Pulitzer Prizes that went to the perpetrators of the lie. So you can kind of see right here how liars get manufactured so promiscuously in our society. There's an incentive to do it. It's going to get you to the pinnacle of your profession. I'm thinking about people like Tom Hamburger of the Washington Post. This is a guy who, along with the New York Times, won Pulitzer Prize. I'm thinking of people like Rosalind Helderman. I'm thinking of people at the hosts at MSNBC and CNN. So this is these are people who are sort of chronic liars. One of the top performers here, David Korn of Mother Jones, just a habitual liar on many fronts. And interestingly, when he was confronted by Eric Wemple of the Washington Post, basically saying, you know, do you feel bad putting out these lies? He's like, no. Well, do you plan to make any corrections, any retractions of all the stuff you put out there? No, he's like, no, I'm not really. I'm on to other things. So what you have here is that in a decent society, this would almost be like a police operation that's been busted for planting evidence on a suspect. And let's just say the whole police department was involved. What do? Root everybody out. Everybody would be fired. In many cases, there would be criminal prosecutions. These are people who would be locked up for what they tried to do. And in this case, they tried to do it not just to an ordinary defendant. They tried to overturn an election. They tried to essentially remove a duly elected president. So this is a horrific collaborative lie, and it should result in editors stepping down, reporters being fired across the board, public accountability, lengthy apologies on page one, and we've seen none of that. Why? Because we don't really have a normal media. They're not in the information business. They're in the propaganda business. So the reason we're not going to get Russia accountability of any real kind is for the simple reason that the propagandists, just like Goebbels, measure that propaganda by its effects. And they say, listen, we might have been lying. We might have known we were lying. But here's what the lie achieved. It took the evil Donald Trump, the big bad Donald Trump, put him up against the wall for 4 years. So measured by that standard, the lie sort of served its purpose. And so even though they're pretending to a kind of public accountability, privately, I think the liars are actually kind of gleeful that they got away with it. Using the internet without ExpressVPN, well, that's like taking a call on a train or bus on speakerphone for everyone to hear. Do you want the whole train to know about how much you weigh, your ailments, your finances, or how much you hate Brian Stelter? Internet service providers know every single website you visit. Internet service providers can sell this information to ad companies and tech giants who then use your data to target you. This is why I use ExpressVPN. It's so secure. No one can get past ExpressVPN's encryption. You just fire up the app, click one button, boom, you're protected. It works on all smart devices. So protect your online privacy by visiting expressvpn.com/Dinesh today. That's expressvpn.com/Dinesh. You'll get an extra 3 months free. Go ahead, expressvpn.com/Dinesh. How did Roseanne Boyland die? Now, there's a new piece of video that's been released as a result of discovery, the government being forced to provide relevant video to defendants in the January 6th trials. And the government, as you know, has been trying, and so far successfully, to block the release of the full video. And the reason of it now appears to be clear, because from the glimpses of video that we do see, we know that in the tunnel, in the kind of infamous tunnel in the Capitol, you have brutal scenes of Capitol police officers beating nonviolent protesters, beating them hitting them with tear gas and spray, hitting them with truncheons, grievously harming them in some cases. And this is not just men, it's also women. And in one of the pieces of video, you see Roseanne Boyland being struck. You see her kind of beginning to fall to the ground. This is probably what caused her death. And this is the explosive aspect of the story, because right after January 6th, the medical examiner in D.C. claimed that Boyland had died of, quote, an accidental acute amphetamine intoxication. In other words, she died of a drug overdose. Now, that seemed implausible for the following reason. Roseanne Boyland is 34 years old. She went to Washington, D.C. with her friend Justin Winchell. And Boyland, although she does take Adderall, it's rare for people to die of Adderall. You took too much Adderall, you drop dead. Fatal doses are rare, and Boyland would have to ingest 25 times her standard dose to die from it. Moreover, why would she take that kind of a dose when heading to a rally carrying a don't tread on me flag, which is what she had at the time? Now, the new court filing that has produced this video is very interesting. You can actually track down the video on social media. I'm a little worried about posting it, partly because these days it's an excuse for taking your podcast down on social media. Oh, it's depicting a lot of violence, even though the violence is violence perpetrated by the government, violence for which the government should be accountable. But the lawyer who got his hands on this evidence has looked at the video, but he's also kind of itemized the video frame by frame. And he has timestamps on each description. So this is what lawyers do, and it's kind of useful to go through it. He's referring to a cop that he calls White Shirt because it's not clear. You can't see the guy's face, but you can see that he is someone in authority. Quote, White Shirt hits the woman in the head with his baton 5 times in 7 seconds. Next, the woman is sprayed directly in the eyes by officer on the ledge. Next, blood is visibly coming out of the woman's head and can be seen on the white hoodie. Next, White Shirt makes his way to front of crowd again and targets women attempting to escape, trying to get away. Next, White Shirt beats the woman with his baton, striking her 8 times in 6 seconds. White Shirt punches the woman in the face with his left hand, landing 5 punches in 5 seconds with all of his might. Officers push the woman around the tunnel. The woman briefly collapses. Now, this woman, there was more than one woman in the tunnel, but this woman now is Roseanne Boyland. White Shirt follows the woman to the front of the tunnel and beats her with his baton as she's falling. The woman is taken to the back of the tunnel and is never seen again. Now, one thing that's really interesting, an interesting tidbit here, is that you remember the testimony of what I call the crying Capitol police officers, Aquino Gonell, Harry Dunn. They're like, oh, you know, I was targeted. These are actually the guys who were in the tunnel. In fact, they testified. Aquilino Gonell, He testified at one point that he was the one who handled Boylan's body after she died. He's the one who dragged her inside the building where he was then met by Harry Dunn, all of which raises an interesting question. Were the crying Capitol police officers the ones who killed Roseanne Boylan? Now, we won't know that until we see all the footage and from all different directions and can easily identify the people involved. But see, right here, I think right here we have the motive for why the government is hiding it. And so they go to these gullible judges, and in some cases they're Obama judges, but in other cases they're Reagan and Trump judges, and they say, oh, there's a national security involved. We can't show this footage. It's gonna give other terrorists information that they can use in the future. That's not the real reason. That has nothing to do with the real reason. The real reason is so people don't know what really happened in D.C., in the tunnel, on January 6th, that day, and in particular, what happened and who killed Roseanne Boylan. Aches and pains come to us all eventually, whether from the normal wear and tear of time or from injury. But now there's a 100% drug-free solution. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. Now, the vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more. Why? Because it works for them. Debbie's been suffering with frozen shoulder for a couple of years now. She decided, let me try it. She found out it works unbelievably well. Her pain just disappeared. And Debbie knows if she doesn't take it regularly, the pain's going to come right back. So she's made a vow never to be without it again. Being able to lift her arm and exercise, that's super important to her. Relief Factor is a tool she needs. She's glad she's got it. Now you too can benefit. You'll see. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number again, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. The Biden administration has finally decided to try to do something about oil prices. And the reason they're trying to do something is not because they've developed a new level of compassion for the American people. It's certainly not because they've realized that their own policies of shutting down pipelines, they're still trying to shut down pipelines. All the environmental nonsense that they're doing, you can't drill here, you can't drill there, you got to protect the snail darter over here, you've got to watch out for climate change over there. So Biden's policies have created this oil crisis. And but now it's affecting his popularity. That's really the, quote, emergency that is causing Biden to act. It's not a real emergency. And so America has a strategic oil reserve. The purpose of this strategic oil reserve is to protect the country in the event of a crisis or an emergency. Let's say, for example, that we're under attack from a foreign power. We need to strike back. Our bombers need access to fuel, so we have a strategic reserve that makes that available. That's the idea behind it. But for Biden, the emergency is that people don't like him as much. And rather than say it's because I'm unlikable and my policies stink and I'm driving up inflation and I've humiliated the country on the national frontier and I've opened the border and I've done all this other stuff, Biden's idea is, well, let's fix the problem by dipping into the strategic reserve. Now, oil prices have nearly doubled from what they were just 1 year ago. And in some places, they have reached just startling levels. I posted on social media, some guy in LA sent us a picture he took with, you know, gas prices around over $6. And so people are really feeling it. And I think they're really irritated because they know that this is not imposed from abroad. This is not OPEC. True, Biden did go to the OPEC cartel and the Russians and beg them to make more oil. Please produce more oil. I mean, the unseemly sight of this old man basically imploring America is not exactly our friends to produce more oil. And then OPEC and Russia go, well, nah, we're not going to do it. And in fact, the Saudis tell Biden, listen, you know, you've been talking about signing some kind of oil deal with Iran. You want to make the nuclear deal with Iran. And so, quite frankly, we don't know what that's going to do to oil prices. And so we're not in the mood to accommodate you on this. So it's a no can do from the OPEC cartel. And so Biden has got to go to the oil reserve. And the good news, I mean, I don't know if it's good news, but it's good news for us politically, is it's probably not going to do much. Because number one, the oil isn't going to be released all that quickly. It could come over a couple of months. And number two, there are many other factors at play, most particularly the simple fact that there's huge demand for oil on the part of India, on the part of China. And so that is driving up the world price. The way to fight that, of course, is to make more oil, to get more natural gas from here in the United States, of which we have a lot. But the Biden administration doesn't want to do that. So this is, as I say, a crisis of their own making, a bogus emergency. It's only a political emergency because Biden is facing really shipwreck, not just in the polls, but he's facing shipwreck at the ballot box next year. So they're scrambling to try to drive the poll ratings up by bringing the gas prices down. But I think we can all see what's going on. It's just more shameless conduct by a shameless president. And best of all, at least from a political point of view, it's not likely to work. You want to do something really smart this month? I'm going to give you a deal to cut your cell phone bill in half. It's called Pure Talk. Pure Talk gives you killer 5G coverage in one of the largest 5G networks in the country and still saves the average family over $800 a year. I made the switch. The coverage is great. The US-based customer service actually cares about you, and Pure Talk's prices are pretty much wholesale. Unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data for just $30 a month. Keep your number, keep your phone. Or this month you can get Black Friday prices on new phones like the iPhone 12 that I got for just $479. They have a 30-day risk-free guarantee, so you literally have nothing to lose. Go to puretalk.com, shop for the plan and phone that's right for you, then enter promo code SAVEHALF, and you'll save 50% off your first month, and you'll save also on a new phone. That's puretalk.com, promo code SAVEHALF. Pure Talk is simply smarter wireless. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. I want to talk about a remarkable phenomenon that is going on in Asia and Africa, namely the large-scale conversion of Muslims to Christianity. Historically, this is completely unprecedented. Historically, it's very difficult, and very few people have converted out of Islam. There are a couple of exceptions to that rule, but in general, well, we know that Islam doesn't like people to convert out. In fact, if you think of the old line about the Hotel California, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. That applies to Islam. You can't leave. And you can't leave to become an atheist, and you can't leave to become a member of another religion. In both cases, it's considered not just losing your faith, but apostasy, betraying the Muslim people. And it's been punishable by imprisonment or beatings or in some cases even death. Remember, for example, the fatwa that was put on Salman Rushdie, the writer, because he was seen as a sort of apostate to Islam. So this strategy of making it difficult, if not impossible, to convert out has historically stopped Muslims from doing it. And there, as I say, are a few exceptions to this rule. In 16th century Spain, once Catholic monarchs got a hold of Spain, they established preferential treatment for Catholics, and they essentially expelled the Moors, the Muslims, from Spain. Now, there were some Muslims at that time who converted to Christianity in order to be able to stay in Spain. But that's an historical exception. Even as late as the 1980s, a missionary wrote a book called 10 Muslims Meet Christ. And while the book focused on 10 Muslim converts, it was very clear from the book itself that this is extremely rare. It's really hard to get a Muslim convert. So, like, I found 10. Let me tell you about their stories. But now, interestingly, in many countries, not just in one particular place, in Algeria, in Albania, in Syria, in Kurdistan, in Egypt, you have Muslims converting to Christianity. In fact, they're converting to Christianity in such numbers that there's even a name for them. They're called MBBs. Pastors call them MBBs, meaning Muslim background believers. Believers, Christian believers who come from a Muslim background. How many converts? No one knows exactly for sure. But from the Muslim side, you have had complaints. There was a complaint by a guy on Al Jazeera who said that by his count, 6 million Muslims are converting to Christianity each year. Think about that. That's a huge number. Traditionally, Muslims have gained forces by conquering. So they don't really convert people to Islam really by persuasion either. They use force. But as I say, very few people convert out. But now that's happening. Now, one of the most... Why is it happening? Well, one reason it's happening is that people are rebelling, Muslims are rebelling against radical Islam. One pastor in Egypt apparently said that the Islamist, the Muslim Brotherhood President Mohamed Morsi, was, quote, the great evangelist. Why? Because the extremism of his policies told a lot of Muslims, wow, this guy's crazy. You know, I don't want to be part of any religion that he's part of. So that's part of the reason for the conversion. But the fact that it's happening in so many different places shows that that's not the only reason. Now, interestingly, when you talk to Christian pastors, and I'm referring here to a very interesting article that quotes a number of these pastors, they claim that the reason that Muslims convert, or at least a substantial number of them convert, is that they have dreams and visions of Jesus Christ. Now, this is a little bit far out, but apparently an Iranian convert, this guy's fairly typical, he said, quote, many people are having dreams and visions about a shining man dressed in white telling them about Jesus. The leader of a Presbyterian church in Pakistan said that there were some Afghan imams who traveled hundreds of miles to study the Bible. And when he was asked, well, why are they doing that? He goes, quote, dreams. Christ appeared to them in their sleep. A Colorado pastor who conducts classes in Arabic via the radio and the internet, he goes, virtually all my students came following dreams, following dreams. There's a missionary named Michael Stallwork, and he is a missionary in Frankfurt. And he said a veiled woman came up to him. He thought it was a beggar. He was about to give her money. But she goes, are you the imam? And he said, well, I'm not an imam, but I am the pastor of this church. And she said, well, in that case, you are the right man. God has commanded me in a dream to go to the big church on the market square and ask for the imam, meaning the priest, to tell me the truth. So I think what I find fascinating about all this is that these people who are having dreams, now Christ is a prophet in Islam. He's called Isa. But interestingly, in these dreams, these Muslims are getting the clear idea that it's not Isa, that it's in fact the Christian Christ that they need to be following, and following through the mechanism of the Christian Bible and the Christian church. It's a little bit hard to know what to make about this, but I think it's thrilling for us as Christians to see that Muslims, who are the hardest people in the world to convert, Islam hasn't really lost the force of its original revelation. I don't entirely know what to make about these strange visitations and dreams, but they seem to be real enough to the people who have them to suggest at least the possibility that God is doing some remarkable work in the world through Muslims, pointing them to Christianity.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.